What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Welcome to this week's edition of Radioactive Magazine with your host, Dave Mitchell. We are on the verge of witnessing a revolution in the growth of renewable energy and battery storage technologies, driven by rapid price drops in the development and implementation of these products. To examine these developments, we have with us today Frank Jacob, PE and PMP, who is a technology manager for energy storage for Black & Veatch's power and renewable energy divisions. Frank has 30 years' experience in developing advanced energy technologies, and his focus the last 15 years has been on product development of batteries and fuel cells as energy storage systems for solar and wind technologies. Frank, we are very pleased to have you with us today on Radioactive Magazine, and welcome.
Thank you, Dave. I'm glad to be here today.
Okay. I'm glad you're here, too. To get right to it, in the article, Powering a Decentralized Grid and Construction Executive, an article provided by you, the Energy Storage Association indicates U.S. storage systems are only 2% of U.S. electrical generating capacity. The IHS indicates the global energy storage market is growing exponentially. In referring to the rapid price drop in lithium-ion battery storage from 2010 to 2018, you indicated further price drops and innovation as you were quoted in that article as saying, as innovation and economies of manufacturing continue, a 10% per year price decline is forecast for the next 5 years. Can you expand on the rapid price drops occurring in energy storage systems and what this means for their expansion into the U.S. electrical grid?
Yes, Dave. I'd love the opportunity to do that. This is a rather rapid time of price reduction. Going back 9 years to 2010, battery storage systems were in excess of $1,000 per unit. And 3 years later, that was down to $500. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, it was at $250, and right now it's dropping below $200.
When you say per unit, are you talking kilowatt hour or per
yes,
unit?
Yes, I am. The unit is the kilowatt hours that it stores.
Oh, okay.
Where one kilowatt hour will operate a U.S. home for 1 hour.
Oh, okay.
And the reason for this price drop is really attributed to the growth of electric vehicles and the rapid expansion of manufacturing of lithium-ion battery cells for the electric vehicle market. Today, the electrical vehicle market is probably five times bigger than the stationary energy market for the grid. And in 10 years, in 2030, it's expected the electric vehicle market would have gone far more exponentially than the storage market. They'll both be big, mm-hmm. but the cost driver is to drive down prices through increased scale of manufacturing, increased learning curve. Every time you do something and it doubles, you usually get a price reduction. It's like going to Costco for your food.
Right.
So that's the driver for this 10% per year price drop.
And so as the manufacturing increases for electric cars, for lithium-ion batteries, that has a direct effect on price drops for battery storage systems for wind and solar. Is that correct?
It does. Okay. The lithium-ion cells aren't exactly AA cells, but they look like those cylindrical cells, mm-hmm. and they're just making millions and billions of those cells for vehicles, and okay. the stationary energy storage markets is able to take advantage of that and use those cells in their stationary energy project.
Okay, let's get to a specific example. California has their 2018 Renewable Energy Portfolio Standard sets a legal goal of 60% renewable energy by 2030 and 100% renewable energy by 2045. How can energy storage systems provide stability to their grid, to the California grid, and what percentage of total electrical generation would be needed? In other words, what percentage of battery storage systems would have to be available in order to provide stability to that grid?
It's a common rule of thumb in the power business that once intermittent and periodic renewable energy gets in excess of 15 to 20% of the total electricity production, then that puts the grid in danger of unstable operation. Think about it. In the past, it was the load that varied. You know, lights came on at night, business operated during the day, and the generators would operate at steady levels, ramping slowly. But with renewable energy, we get a boost of solar-driven electricity between sunrise and sunset, and it peaks in the middle of the day when we don't really need as much as we do later in the day, and that's where storage will time shift the energy. Wind is more periodic, it's sometimes higher at night than during the day, and those add together to provide some hybrid stability to overall renewables. And as an engineer and scientist, I think 20, 30, 40% is achievable. 50% will require innovation in the industry.
50% penetration by renewables is what you're referring to?
Yes, yes.
Okay. And from a layman's point of view, it seems to me that energy storage systems would provide a pretty good amount of stability to intermittent systems that renewable energies possess.
They do.
I know that the U.S. electrical grid, we mentioned that it had just 2% battery storage systems. But I don't know what California's is, but what percent of battery storage systems of their entire electrical generating capacity would batteries have to, would it be, 20, 30, 40% battery storage system coverage, or I don't know.
I think that's achievable. Mm-hmm. I'd like to expand to just general storage in that there are technologies coming along, thermal storage and others, that will provide longer durations than batteries can provide. Remember, a battery doesn't generate electricity.
Right.
It stores it at one time and discharges it at another. After it's discharged, it's got to recharge.
Right. So if, as California, say for example, if California does meet their standard of getting to 60% renewable energy by 2030, what would be the level of battery storage that would be needed to provide stability to a grid with 60% renewables by 2030?
For second by second, minute by minute, hour by hour stability, probably 20 to 30% of the generating capacity.
So fairly substantial.
In order to provide, say, day to day in periods of cloudy weather, or season to season, in terms of dry season and wet season for hydro, then other storage technologies are going to be needed than batteries.
Okay. So if California, they want to expand to 100% renewable energy by 2045, in your view, is that possible? And the second part of that question would be, what would the level of battery storage and or other what level of battery storage would be needed in order to cover for 100% renewable energy grid in California by 2045.
Well, that goal there has two elements, 100% and by 2045. I have great faith in engineering and science, and we could work out green, sustainable energy of the future at 100%. But can we do that by 2045? I'm not so sure.
Mm-hmm.
I think other technologies will be needed, and some power agencies have sought to see how a balance between renewables and, say, very clean combined cycle gas generation provides a far more stable grid than with energy storage alone. And we'll get to an example of that in one of your next questions.
Okay, okay. Yeah, I think, yeah, as far as, you know, we do talk about, you know, the issue of intermittency of renewable energy is a real problem. Let's talk about that a little bit. The
sure.
the primary renewable energy technologies are wind, solar, and hydro. And according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, hydro peaks in the spring due to snowmelt and spring rains. Wind peaks in the spring and fall. And solar peaks in the summer. Can you expand on those characteristics and how each of those sources can be used to supplement the other?
Sure, sure. And I'd even suggest that they complement each other. They are additive at times, and other times, you know, the sun makes up for the peaks during the day, and in the fall and winter, the wind could take on the peaks. But let's talk about two terms, intermittent and periodic. Intermittent kind of has a time scale of seconds and minutes. Periodic has the seasonal aspect that the Energy Information Administration talks about, hydro being higher in the spring due to certain causes. I will tell you that Costa Rica is an interesting case study. I've had an example to advise them on energy storage. And the way they operate, they have 200 or more days a year that are 100% renewable. But getting the next 165 days to get a full year is not in the cards for them right now because of spring, because of the rainy season. There are also times where a year or two will go by without rain, and the hydro resources will go down, and they'll have to then bump off being completely renewable and having to use conventional resources. Mm-hmm. So that seasonality and periodicity is needed to happen.
Uh-huh.
So for the other extreme.
So for Costa Rica, just as an example, do they get is what's the percentage of hydro in Costa Rica?
Average, it's 80%.
80%. So okay.
That's, so 200 days of the year, it's 100%.
Uh-huh.
And 165 of those other days is when they have to augment hydro with more conventional generation.
Oh, okay. So
they have neither strong land for solar resource, quite mountainous to put solar panels out.
I see.
And wind might be possible, but it hasn't developed there yet.
Okay. Are there? Do they have any kind of storage system available at all, or is it just purely dependent upon the amount of water available to run their hydro plants?
They have what are called pumped hydro facilities, along with their regular hydro, when the you know, dams they've built that water flows through to generate electricity, or what's called run of river hydro. That's where you take some water off a river, run it through a turbine, and put it back in the river. Whenever that's in excess of what the load is, then they could send that electricity to the pumped hydro facility, and that'll pump water uphill to be used later on. And that's later on in the day, or later on in the week, or maybe later on in the season.
So getting back to the three main sources, solar, wind, and hydro, how do they? What are some other ways that they complement or supplement each other?
There's a popular notion growing first internationally and now here in the States with the announcement of a hybrid solar, wind, and storage farm in the upper Midwest. And that's just because, as I said, that those resources complement each other. As the sun's going down, sometimes the wind's picking up, and you get more level generation from the combination of the two than any single one. The differences between load and generation then are stored in batteries, and that could be used later on in the evening as the household loads start picking up as people return from work.
Mm-hmm. Did I think a little bit earlier you mentioned, I think you mentioned using natural gas turbines to cover for to cover a grid that's approaching 100% renewable energy. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So really, battery storage would not be enough, is what you're saying.
I don't see it in my future.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
But I have trust in science and technology that some form of storage could be used
right
to build that bridge.
Okay. But for right now, as a grid approaches 100%, you would still need natural gas turbines, I assume? Natural gas peaker plants?
If by then we invent biofuel turbines or other forms of carbon-free fuels, then they may substitute.
Okay. But there definitely is going to have to be something, some kind of a facility that would burn something in order to produce electricity to provide baseload, basically. Is that kind of what we're looking at?
These would be what are commonly called peaker plants.
Whenever
the peak's greater than what the generation is, they have to come online to keep the grid from getting unstable and blacking out.
Okay.
I'd back up one point. You said we'd have to burn something. If we were able to store thermal energy, say sunlight, and that's what these power towers in the desert do, that shine mirrors up on a container of salt. It melts the salt.
Right.
It sits there at several hundred degrees, and then it's used to form steam that turns a regular turbine. But there's no combustion or burning required for that.
Right. My understanding, I think you're referring to the Crescent Dunes solar thermal plant.
That's one of them, yes.
Right. And my understanding on that particular facility is that I think they went online in the last fairly recently, but they've not been able to produce the amount of electricity that was anticipated. So
it is a new technology and a rather massive project, but consider this. When there's excess wind, run that excess electricity through little heaters that are spread through this molten salt material and heat it up.
Uh-huh.
We know very well how to convert heat into steam and use steam to turn a machine to generate power.
Turn a turbine, right. Let's get back to the kind of the issue of there is a real life example of kind of a problem with the island of Kauai. You sent me an article from UtilityDive.com indicating an island wide outage on the island of Kauai, where clouds blocked solar recovery after a generator's cable failure. And that particular utility, their largest generator, suffered a cable failure, and it went offline and caused a cascading effect on other generating sources. The utility in question will have 70% renewable energy by the end of 2019 and had recently installed a solar and battery storage system that helped them maintain power. However, due to an approaching storm with cloudy days, they were unable to provide full power to their grid, and they had to do rolling blackouts of 30 minutes every 3 to 4 hours for at least the next 24 hours. What were the flaws in that utility grid, and as they move to 100% renewable energy by 2045, how can they fix them?
So for the geeks among us, in designing power delivery systems, there's contingency analysis that goes on, either N or N minus one contingencies, where you work through what happens if I lose this generator, what happens to maintain power, and if I lose two generators, what happens to maintain power. And one reason our grid is so stable is because that analysis has been done. But in this case, in Kauai, they lost three things. And electrical, mechanical equipment fails once in a while, and their generators, which are diesel generators, by the way, they use diesel fuel, and it has to be shipped in, and folks in Hawaii pay about 25 cents per kilowatt hour compared to the 10 cents or less that we pay here in the Midwest. So it's a far more favorable economic environment for renewables, and several of these solar storage plants have been built. I believe there are two there by now in the past 2 years. And they're allowing them to reduce their diesel fuel consumption by having this solar and solar plus storage system there. Uh-huh. But when they lost all of their generators, they were not able to deliver all the energy the grid needed. Mm-hmm. So one alternative is to load shed, just deliver power to those to a subset of the customers, and then fairly shift that around to the different distribution networks so that no one is unduly burdened.
Mm-hmm. And, well, I think the problem is that as I understood it, was that the solar and battery system, when their system went down, they had cloudy days, so the solar panels were not able to fully... they weren't going at full capacity, and if the day was sunny, would they have been able to cover their grid, or would it still not have been adequate?
I don't have the exact numbers, but certainly far fewer of their customers would have been impacted, and maybe that rolling blackout would have been far shorter if absent at all. Uh-huh. I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay. I think they have, my understanding is that their grid is that it would be at 70% renewable energy by the end of this year, which means that they have to have most of that probably already installed. And so something happened where they had a problem with... So if they had had a natural gas peaker turbine or something, they would have been able to more adequately cover that. But did they have one like that or not?
No, they did not.
Okay.
No, they did not. The main generating station is what went down.
Okay.
And so that was the N minus one contingency. Then the solar was left to be able to supply it, but then some cloudy weather came through.
Right. Okay.
So that was the N minus two contingency that then put them into a rolling blackout situation.
Right. Right. So that was definitely an issue. Let's look at the energy profile according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. The new information you provided me just a short time ago was that in 2019, utility scale solar was at 2.3% of the total U.S. electrical grid. hydro this year will be at 7.0%, and wind will be at 6.6%. And so combined, all of those percents are
15 or so.
15, yeah, 15 or a little bit more, I think. So that's not a lot. I mean, the rest of the grid would be, I'm assuming, would be coal, natural gas, and nuclear. And
yes.
But you know, there's been really quite a rapid buildup of wind, and I think solar in the last several years. And there's some very rapid price drops going on with wind, solar, and battery technologies. What are the range of estimates that you're aware of for penetration of wind and solar into the U.S. electrical grid under current market and subsidy conditions over the next 10 to 15 years? Do you have some information on that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And if you think about the major renewable components that we talked about, hydro, which is greatest today, wind which is
solar.
Approaching hydro, mm-hmm. and solar, that's about a third of what they are.
Uh-huh.
You are right. There's going to be a rapid rise in the amount of solar and wind between now and 2022. Because there are federal tax incentives that help make all the projects financially viable, and people are rushing to take advantage of those before those incentives go away.
Uh-huh.
After that, it's still going to increase, but not at such a rapid rate. It's looking to me that we'll go from about 15 to 25% renewables by 2030.
So 15 to 25% renewables by 2030? Under
yes.
current conditions. And
under current conditions.
Okay. I know, do you have any predictions for beyond 12 years, say 15 or 20 more years from now?
Normally people talk about either 2030 or 2050,
uh-huh.
which is like a 30-year time horizon. So,
right.
So 30 to 35% renewables by then. Absent any carbon taxes or things coming into play that were once on the table are now off the table federally, but there are many states and local agencies still pursuing carbon reductions.
Okay. So, Frank, that number again for 2050 would be?
30 to 35%,
given ongoing conditions, basically.
Giving ongoing conditions, which include reduced nuclear, reduced coal, and about consistent natural gas and renewables taking up the gaps.
Okay. Well, obviously we have a long way to go, and as a society, and this gives some perspective to the developments going on, and Frank, I really appreciate your expertise in providing this information to us today.
Oh, you're welcome, Dave. Energy has been my passion for my career, so I enjoy the opportunity to talk with you about it.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much, Frank. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay.
And thank you, David, for an interesting program again this week. And tune in to Radioactive Magazine next week when Susan Sarachak will be talking with De La Salle Center. Now, of course, De La Salle has been around for a number of years here in Kansas City, and they have some very exciting programs that I think you're going to want to tune in and find out a little bit about. Some upcoming things happening here in our community. Tonight at 7 o'clock, the Kansas City Democratic Socialists of America present a prison abolition work group. That's at the Kansas City Public Library, Central Library, 14 West 10th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. So that's just about 30 minutes from now down to the Public Library. So toodle on down. Or also tonight, KC Extinction Rebellion KC presents Climate Emergency Volunteer Action Meeting. That's also tonight from 6:30 to 8:30, and that's at the Jacob Wells Church, 42nd Wyoming. And then on Sunday, August the 11th, the Sierra Club and five other environmental groups presents the Green New Deal in Kansas City. Andres Burnell, who is a personal advisor to Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, will be there. So you can learn a lot about the Green New Deal and how we can support that here in Kansas City. Again, that's Sunday, August the 11th, at the Unity Temple on the Plaza, 707 West 47th Street. Well, keep your radio tuned right here to KKFI for Counterspin, followed by Taste of Tejano, coming up right after the following messages.
Ebony's Bones is a kitchen table conversation that explores the souls of black folk as we decolonize and question everything that we've been told to believe. Tune in Thursday, August 8th at 7 p.m. and have a seat at the table.
Did you miss one of your favorite programs this week? No worries. Now you can listen to any of our programs from the last 2 weeks at archive.kkfi.org.
Every 3 years, the big three auto companies, Ford, Chrysler, and GM, negotiate a new contract with the United Auto Workers. This week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll have a conversation with UAW workers about working conditions, pay and job security, as well as expectations about the new contract. Will this contract bring no more tears? Tune in Thursday at 6 p.m., rebroadcast Friday, 5 a.m.
On the next Sprouts.
Now currently caught trespassing on the United States Department of Energy. You are not authorized to enter upon this property, and you are requested to leave immediately. If you do not leave, you will be arrested.
Part 2 of Peaceworks Casey's annual Memorial Day Civil Disobedience at the Kansas City Weapons Plant. Sprouts, Thursday at noon.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the harms of climate disruption are already terrible and will only get worse. And despite what appears to be some people's magical thinking, no one will be unaffected. What's more, the drivers of climate disruption are known, and it isn't people who leave the lights on. What's missing is a public and media dialogue that features fossil fuel industries and their leaders accurately as roadblocks to the climate justice solutions we desperately need. While federal inaction and even regression is distressing, some state attorneys general are pushing forward for accountability. We'll talk about that movement with Sriram Madhusudanan, Deputy Campaigns Director with the group Corporate Accountability. Also on the show, Warren Kanders has resigned from the board of New York's Whitney Museum, a casualty to the social justice mob, as one account had it, or, for others, a victory for those who prefer their art without a side order of complicity with the manufacture of tear gas and high-velocity ammunitions. A few months ago, Counterspin spoke with Amin Hussein, core organizer with the group Decolonize This Place, on the forefront of activism around cultural institutions. We'll revisit that conversation today. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Climate disruption presents a test for corporate news media. Will they act on the understanding that a conversation that doesn't acknowledge that unprecedented measures need to be taken is an irresponsibly detached conversation? Will they vigorously expose the corporate actors, the fossil fuel companies and their executives who continue to dissimulate and deny? Or will they go on giving those that profit from harm-causing industries pride of place in the conversation about how to mitigate that harm? Corporate media's response to some promising state-level developments in climate action is not itself very promising. Our next guest will explain work you might not know about being done to push fossil fuel companies out of the way of climate justice solutions. Shriram Madhusudanan is Deputy Campaigns Director at the group Corporate Accountability. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Shriram Madhusudanan.
Thank you so much, Jeanine. Glad to be here.
Well, I was alluding to the Supreme Court decision earlier this year that cleared the way for Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey to pursue her investigation of ExxonMobil about what it knew about climate change and when it knew it, essentially. It was on the wires, AP and Reuters, but it didn't get the kind of major attention you would hope. But before you talk about that, the background for such an investigation, the need for it, is that the fossil fuel industry is just vigorous in doing whatever it takes to resist change. They're really quite aggressive and proactive, you might say.
Absolutely. You know, I think this is a story we've seen play out over decades, really, when we now see the internal documents that have come to light. For example, showing that Exxon, as far back as the 1960s, really knew the extent to which climate change was going to be the path that we were on, the modern kind of climate disruption that we're seeing almost a climate disaster happen every week, I believe, according to a recent UN report. So it is very telling that this is the path the fossil fuel industry has been on for so long, and when faced with a choice of doing a better thing in terms of advancing a just transition or choosing a path of climate denial and political manipulation, the industry quite simply chose to protect billions and billions of dollars a year in its own profit.
And this was part of that. Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey was investigating ExxonMobil, so as part of their strategy, they sued her. And that's the case that the Supreme Court refused to hear?
That's right, yes. So the Supreme Court really refused to hear Exxon's bid for dismissal on the Massachusetts AG case. And, you know, just to back up for a second, Exxon has really fought tooth and nail against every move to hold it legally liable, countersuing up a storm, not just with the Massachusetts Attorney General investigation, but a number of different instances. And this is quite simply a tactic of delay and intimidation and an attempt to use their considerable resources to delay, distract, and fundamentally to obstruct this process.
Well, Healey said that she thought the Supreme Court ruling might put an end to what she called Exxon's scorched earth campaign to block these kinds of investigations. As you're intimating, this ruling, it's heartening not only for Massachusetts, though. Massachusetts is not alone in this sort of investigation.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a big win for other states, cities, and communities who want to hold Exxon accountable. We have an ongoing investigation and lawsuit from Attorney General James now in New York State, and there are a number of cities that are taking the fossil fuel industry to court. And, you know, this decision really does clear the way for Healey's investigation into what Exxon has known for over 50 years about climate change and brings us one step closer to finding out exactly what they knew and what they did to cover it up.
So it's having some echo effect in some sense. It was a state attorney general that brought the big lawsuit, or one of them that became a biggest lawsuit against big tobacco, was it not?
Yes, and there's absolutely a number of parallels to the history we saw with attorney general investigations into the tobacco industry. One, for example, is that as we saw with the tobacco AG investigations, part of the settlement in the U.S., particularly from Minnesota state attorney general, was to bring to light and release a trove of internal documents that really illustrated the true story of what the industry had been doing to cover up what it knew about the addictive nature of nicotine and cigarettes. And similarly, we can see really to what extent Exxon and others hid from the public the causes and severity of the climate crisis. And I think more importantly, when those tobacco documents were released and the truth of what the industry did was revealed, it really ushered in a whole new era of accountability and legislation to hold the industry accountable. And at the international level, at the UN, at the state and local level here in the U.S., people are similarly demanding accountability for the fossil fuel industry. And this is exactly the kinds of investigation and moves to hold the industry accountable and liable for its actions that we need in this moment.
Yeah, documents make things harder to deny, even if they're things that, you know, seem like they're going on in broad daylight anyway. Documentation is always important. And fossil fuel companies are kind of a big PR operation. You know, they do their own research. They offer these market-based solutions. And for corporate media, that's enough cover. You know, oh, this didn't come from BP. It came from the Energy Futures Institute, you know, or whatever, horse hockey, you know, to present that as like a valid position in a debate. You know, some people say X, Y, or Z. And I kind of wonder what it will take for extractive industry to be presented that way in the media instead of this kind of credulity that we see. You know, I feel like media has to take a turn in the same way that it did with tobacco, in terms of the way it presents these corporate actors.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. Media has an incredibly important role to play in telling this story, and it shouldn't be understated. You know, we cannot talk about climate change enough, and it's important that when we talk about it, we tell the story in the right way. So to one foreground, the fact that the industry has known about the severity of climate change for decades, I mean, I mentioned as far back as the 1960s, but a recent document came to light within this initial trove of documents from Exxon that showed that in the 1980s, they knew and had predicted with a fair degree of accuracy what the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere would be in 2019. And that's just astounding to think that before I was born, for example, that Exxon had known exactly what it was doing if it kept on this path of extractive economy and of climate disruption. And so media has an absolutely critical role to play in foregrounding who was responsible, and that where we are today in a moment of upheaval and climate disruption was also a deliberate choice on the part of a number of incredibly powerful entities, corporations, and CEOs at the helms of those entities as well.
Yeah, you can't keep bringing these folks forward as sort of credible actors once you know that dissimulation has been part of their modus operandi, it seems to me. It should affect the way they're treated as sources on these stories.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then to take it one step further, to really address and to have a much more skeptical eye to the trade associations, which you mentioned earlier, that are driving their agenda, you know, seemingly under the guise of being nonprofits or acting in the public interest, simply putting forward quote-unquote innovative solutions, when in fact they were set up for very intentional purposes by the industry to advance an industry-driven agenda and to seed these false market-based solutions that at the end of the day don't do anything to actually shift the industry's business model, which is fundamentally at odds with the direction we need to go as a collective species on this planet if we're going to weather the storm, so to say.
Well, a recent piece by your corporate accountability colleague, Patty Lynn, that I saw in Truthout reminded us that under today's global power structures, the people who will be the most affected are the same ones who are currently experiencing the harshest effects of climate change. No wonder then that women, communities of color, communities in the global south, youth, low-income communities, and indigenous communities around the world have been developing just climate solutions that will address this crisis. What we need now is to move the fossil fuel industry and its backers out of the way so these solutions can be implemented. There really isn't a scientific or even an environmental response to climate disruption that is not a political response to current relationships of power, is there really?
You know, that's absolutely right, and I think it's a really critical point to bear that there are very real solutions to addressing the climate crisis, and they're being deployed by people around the world, and in the U.S. most impacted by this crisis today, solutions like energy democracy, agroecological practices, ecological restoration to recover natural carbon sinks, and just in a moment, if you imagine where we could be today in implementing these kinds of climate solutions if the industry had not for so long really stood in the way, it's damning when you think about it from that perspective. But absolutely what's needed in this moment is for the industry to get out of the way and for us to make sure that these real solutions that are already being deployed in communities around the world are given the center of focus and the scale that they need in order to really be the focus of a global response to this crisis.
We've been speaking with Sriram Madhusudanan, Deputy Campaigns Director at the group Corporate Accountability. You can find their work online at corporateaccountability.org. Sriram Madhusudanan, thanks so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
Warren Kanders resigned from his position as vice chair of the board of the Whitney Museum July 25th, saying he didn't want to play a role, however inadvertent, in the museum's demise. The advertent role that Kanders played was to fund his philanthropy with profits from Safariland, a company that makes tear gas canisters used against protesters around the world, and Sierra Bullets, that sells ammunition used against Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Activists, artists, and other humans objected. Kanders' resignation doesn't mean the end of the work of groups like Decolonize This Place, who organized around Kanders, as well as a planned event at New York's Museum of Natural History involving fascist Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. As long as cultural institutions are important sites of public conversation, but the public doesn't have much to say in who gets to lead that conversation or the stories they tell, activists will be asking us to talk about what that means and what it would mean to change it. That's what we talked about a few months ago with Decolonize This Place core organizer Amin Hussein. Welcome to Counterspin, Amin Hussein.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you first a sort of big question. The theater, museums, art galleries, they're seen in the United States as noblesse oblige, rich people giving back for the public betterment. Is part of the difficulty of demanding some kind of accountability or even transparency the way that these institutions are structured from the get-go and who they see themselves as accountable to?
Yeah, I mean, we've been looking at these cultural institutions for a while, and, you know, they're not supported publicly in any material way, so then they rely on one percenters, if we can just use that language loosely. And I think within that, they end up not hospitable to communities that they claim to serve. But yet they paddle the idea of like, oh, this is a community space, everyone's welcome, you're a part of the public is who we cater to. But in fact, there's a whole other economy going on in which the people with a lot of money giving money to these cultural institutions are really determining what aesthetics is, what culture is, what's worth showing, who does it cater to. And it ends up excluding most of the people, if we're going to talk about New York and the city, focusing on the American Museum of Natural History because each museum has its specificity. We call it a hall of white supremacy. If you've visited the American Museum of Natural History that gets a lot of public funding, you realize that, oh, there's a hall for African people, and there's a hall for African mammals, and there's a hall for Asian people, and there's a hall for Asian mammals. But there's no hall for European people. There's no hall for white people. And these are the kind of things that, you know, you see these cultural institutions talking about education, but then what they are doing is perpetuating white supremacy in the children that go to visit. These are some of the things that we're calling attention to, but we're not naive to what's going on. In a way, museums have always been conceived of as colonial structures. They're a reflection of the society we live in. And at the same time, we know that they can be something different. And if they're not going to be something different, then they're no longer going to get a pass on both pretending to be something good, but in actually advancing that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we find that the same with news media, you know, who are, as we remind regularly, profit-driven businesses that are public in their impact, but not in their decision-making. Museums, as you're saying, are a site for a bigger project that involves, you know, telling ourselves about ourselves and who gets to tell that story. Well, we'll come back certainly to that broader idea, but I do want to ask about Decolonize This Place's increasingly visible work around Warren Kanders and the Whitney Museum of American Art. Who is Kanders and what's at stake there?
So yeah, thanks for the question. I mean, Warren Kanders is a person who is the owner of Safariland Group. The Safariland Group owns many subsidiaries that create, as they call them, non-lethal solutions. Really what they produce and the way this came to our attention is they produced the tear gas that was used in Egypt, that was used in Bahrain, that was used in Turkey, that's been used in Ferguson against protesters, that was used in Baltimore. They also supply vests and holsters to the NYPD. They provide, through subsidiaries, ballistic bullets that are lethal, that are used in Palestine. And so when that came to our attention, it was surprising. The degree, I think what was surprising is the degree by which a person like Warren Kanders could be a vice president of the Whitney Museum Board of Trustees. That was a little bit shocking, considering that the Whitney puts on shows around protests, around, you know, defining what American contemporary art looks like. And to the broader public, I think the world looks at what the Whitney Museum puts up. And so for us, what we've tried to say, both as artists and as people living in the city, to the Whitney, is that no, Kanders can't be on a board of the Whitney Museum that claims to be a progressive institution, that claims to serve a public interest. We understand that there are many Warren Kanders. You know, Davos family is on the board of trustees. You have the Crown family on the board of trustees. But what we're saying is that Kanders is a prime example of what's wrong with our cultural institutions, and that the Whitney is being held accountable. And what happens when you hold an institution like the Whitney accountable is that it sends a signal out in the world to other cultural institutions, but also to the people, to the communities that are being harmed by it, that we stand in solidarity with them, that we understand that we do have power, that we're not powerless, and that museums and institutions like the Whitney, they either are accountable to the communities they claim to serve, or they're going to be protested in a way that impacts their branding.
Right. We have such a confused view of wealth and of rich people, I think, in this country, that you can see someone who makes their money off misery. You know, there's no other way to put it. And yet we will say, well, but if they use that money and create a space where inner city kids get to look at a Van Gogh, you know, well, does maybe that all sort of balance out? And I mean, in addition to the sort of idea about the ideas, the cultural reproduction of colonialism and of white ideas of white supremacy, it's really that these institutions, in some sense, act as money launderers.
Thank you for saying that. They do act as money laundering businesses, but I think people are naive about the art world in general. I think that we as artists and as broader communities care about art and understand it has a deep value. But I think that the people with wealth, this wealth is finding a home in something called the art system. Look at Jeff Koons' piece, The Rabbit Costs Approximately $70 million. This artist has a rabbit. It costs $70 million. Why does anything cost $70 million? It's a question that we have to really contend with. And I think the answer isn't simply because it's art and a brilliant person made it. It's actually deeper than that. It houses this wealth that's stolen, and then it gets traded between people who own wealth, and then you get tax breaks or tax write-offs or off of your kind of tax ledger. And I think that this is what's happening with these institutions. These institutions make rich people look better in the way that they're doing kind of philanthropy, but it's not really philanthropy. And then at the same time, they're getting all these write-offs and hiding their money, and then their money comes out in art objects, and these art objects are somehow worth $70 million or $20 million or $10 million.
Right. Well, I want to just go back and say, we heard that the American Museum of Natural History staff, many of them were, you know, gobsmacked. And I know that Whitney staffers, too, many of them are with you in this fight. I mean, you know, the staff inside these institutions are part of the fight, too, right?
Absolutely. I think this is what's been really important about both the American Museum of Natural History and the Whitney Museum. And shout out to all the staff that have organized. And I think people forget that the organizing around the Whitney Museum happened with the staff. Front end and back end of the museum, over 100 staff members signed a letter asking for the removal of Kanders, for some principles of transparency around where the funding, and some ethical guidelines some money you should say no to. That's a minimum basis for a different kind of conversation. I think what we've done with our actions, going to the Whitney every week, and the eighth week is coming up, is to speak to the staff, to go in advance, to talk to them, to share food with them. We've explained, we understand the inconvenience that protest creates. We know that they're employed. We know we live in a society in which people have to pay bills, and working at the museum is one of the things by which you pay bills. We understand that institutions are complex. What we're targeting is the leadership of the Whitney Museum, and we're making sure to make, to the degree possible, to not make the lives of the employees difficult.
I wanted to ask one question about media. A Decolonize This Place press release last year quoted Whitney director Adam Weinberg in his praise of the museum as a safe space for unsafe ideas, and it reminded me of one news article I saw that lumped the Whitney campaign for the removal of Candors, lumped it in with other scandals at museums, including, you know, sexually explicit art and Britain cleaning the Elgin marbles. Not taking them, but cleaning them. And it sort of felt like, oh, museums are lightning rods. They get it from all sides. And aren't they very brave to allow people to disagree? You know, and I've seen some heartening media coverage, but I've also seen some kind of containing media coverage. And I wonder what you would hope that journalists looking at your work would take away from it and what you would hope they would not.
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think the stakes, as I mentioned, the stakes are high at the Whitney. This isn't about museums being a lightning rod. This is about the injustices and domination and oppression that exist in our society that materially impact our lives in this city, right, being materialized in a place like the Whitney. What that allows for us then is not to speak of isms like capitalism or, you know, state violence in a very abstract sense, but understand both how it works, how are we complicit, how are museums not neutral in that fight. I mean, people forget that when Trump was elected, the Whitney Museum patted itself on the back when it called for J20, right? J20 was all of the political, so-called political artists gathering together and speaking out against fascism. Where are they today? So you can put up a show that brings a lot of people in a comfortable space to speak out against fascism, but when you have Warren Canders, a vice president of the Board of Trustees at the Whitney, everyone falls silent. These are the kind of conversations that we want to have. We don't presume to know, I don't presume to know the answers. I just know that that's wrong. And it's also why we held the town hall. What we imagine is that outlets other than art outlets will cover this. We've seen some headway around this in terms of the Gothamist. We're on the radio show with you. This is great. I think Democracy Now! Did a little segment. But the sad thing about media is that they only cover the drama. So when we're protesting and also gathering and being in spaces doing things, that may not be newsworthy. But when we lit sage in the museum in December, the New York Post covered it, the Daily News covered it. And I think there's something about this kind of coverage that is somewhat superficial, that it follows a particular formula, when in fact the people that are doing this work are from movements, are organizers, and artists, and educators, and young people, student organizers, and elders, and people from communities as far out as East New York. I mean, this Friday, we're taking over subway cars from East New York all the way to the Whitney. Because what's happening at the Whitney isn't just about a museum. It's about spaces of sites of specificity of how oppression and domination gets exercised against us. And it's a way for us to reclaim, hold accountable, and change the nature of the conversation. And we hope that more media outlets will begin to see that there's a deeper story here than simply a protest. In a way, a protest doesn't do service to the kind of thinking that's going on right now. What does it mean to reclaim a city if not to reclaim our institutions?
That was Amin Hussein, core organizer with Decolonize This Place, speaking with Counterspin this past May. You can find the group's statement on Warren Kander's resignation on their site, decolonizethisplace.org. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.